What's up, guys? Brandon Grimm here. This is episode 2 of the Overcomers Podcast. I want to thank you for listening. For all other episodes, past or future, you can go to www.brandongrimm.org/podcast. I'm also on Anchor. This is the app that I'm going to be uploading the podcast through. It's anchor.fm/Brandon Grimm. And I'll also be posting links on all of my social media at BrandonGrimm247. On this episode, this is episode 2, this is going to be an interview that I conducted with Sarah Cawley back in December. And Sarah's a wife, mother of 2. Her youngest daughter has special needs, and Sarah was also diagnosed with breast cancer, and she's going to talk about those situations as we go throughout the interview. If you want to know more about Sarah's story and you want to read her blog, you can go to jascawleyfamily.blogspot.com. jascawleyfamily.blogspot.com. All right. Thanks for joining me. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks. How are you?
I'm doing good. What's going on in your world? Anything?
Just busy Christmas season, you know, yes. Shopping, preparing for the holidays, you know, trying to bring out all the traditions that we have, you know, with the kids and everything. So,
right. Yep. Is there a favorite tradition that you have?
With the kids, I'd say, just reading, we usually read the Christmas story, or do like a little Advent devotional, for every day, Christmas day, mm-hmm. 1 through 25 of December. So,
that's dedication.
It definitely is dedication, but I think it's important for them to kind of grow up, you know, knowing the true meaning behind Christmas and, just kind of having that, faith balance and background. And,
sure.
So yeah.
Cool. So you have 2 daughters.
I do. I have 2 little ones. Addison was born in 2009. Mm-hmm. And then my youngest, Megan, came along 3 years later in 2012.
Yes. And that's kind of around the time where life took a turn for you, right?
Yeah. I would say that over the past 5 years, there's definitely been some growth that's happened in our life. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like we've been through this kind of big traumatic period, and it certainly was surrounding the birth of our youngest. So, yeah.
So she was born 2013?
She was born in 2012.
2012.
Yes. And so, yeah, so we actually, you know, Joe and I had been married for, you know, a little over, what was 2012? 12, so 2011, so 6 years. So by the time you know, we got pregnant with Megan, we'd been married for 6 years. Everything was going great. You know, we both had our careers. We had our little one, and, you know, everything was pretty much just mm-hmm. as we had pictured. And then we went in for a routine ultrasound where, you know, everyone thinks it's the ultrasound where you find out what the gender of the baby will mm-hmm. be, but really that is an anatomy scan to kind of check up on things and make sure that the baby is growing the way it's supposed to. And I remember kind of lying there on the table, and the ultrasound technician is just kind of, you know, going back and forth and back and forth, and she's taking more and more pictures. And, you know, this was really in very sharp contrast to our first ultrasound mm-hmm. gender reveal experience where everything was happy and she's pointing things out. And this time the sonographer was completely quiet, and she was just taking tons of pictures and tons of pictures. And I asked her, I said, you know, is something wrong? And she's like, well, the doctor will be in. And I kind of knew in that moment that something was very, very wrong. So the perinatologist came in and sat down, and, you know, he said, I'm very sorry, but your little girl has hydrocephalus, and it's very severe. And so at that point, you know, because I'm in the medical field, I kind of knew that hydrocephalus was a condition where there's too much fluid that builds up in the brain. There's, you have ventricles in your brain that drain the spinal fluid down your spinal cord and everything. And so basically there's little tracks that it flows through, and one of those tracks in her brain ended up congenitally being malformed and forming a blockage. So, mm-hmm. You know, during the pregnancy, her those little balloons actually filled up kind of with fluid, and so it compressed the brain tissue. So, you know, that would just causes usually like an enlarged head and then very little brain matter. So he kind of explained to me that this was very severe, that it already looked very severe because it was so early on, and that we could consider having an abortion. And so, you know, we of course said no, and just knew that, you know, for better or for worse, mm-hmm. like this is, you know, she's meant to be ours. And so kind of moved on from that day. It pretty much changed the rest of our lives, and it's kind of when the trauma started.
Sure, sure. So if you could go back kind of in your head right now,
mm-hmm.
when you went home that night, do you remember that feeling, or over the next couple of days?
I mean, yeah.
Can you describe?
Absolutely.
I mean, obviously it wasn't a positive feeling, but can you just describe that?
Yeah, those feelings are, you know, still very vivid. I mean, I think that it's one thing when something happens to you, but when it's your child,
mm-hmm.
It is the most helpless, grief-stricken feeling that you could possibly imagine, at least, you know, thus far for me. That was probably the worst day of my life.
Sure.
Was just hearing that. I remember Joe and I came home, you know, there's all these thoughts that are running through your head. You're thinking, oh my goodness, it's a brain condition. So what does this mean? This means, you know, that she could be, you know, completely disabled, like not have any cognitive function. What does that mean for the rest of our life? The doctor actually told us that she might not even survive the pregnancy. So what does that mean? Does that mean mm-hmm. we're going to lose this baby? You know, here I'm married and we've been married for 6 years, but we've never even talked about what does that look like if we have a child with special needs. It's something we never even sure. considered as a possibility.
Especially so, after your first daughter was born.
Yeah, after Addie was born, you know, she was healthy. Everything was great. You know, we never expected anything. We don't have any family history of any problems mm-hmm. like that. You know, so it just really, it came as a complete shock. And so I remember we went home and we actually sat down and, you know, lots of tears, lots of, you know, just trying to like, you know, take a deep breath. And I felt very strongly like we needed to name her, because I knew that we needed to start praying for her. And
sure.
so we decided on a name, and we actually claimed Psalm 139, 14 for her. And it's, I praise your Lord for your fearfully and wonderfully made. And it was just a reminder to both of us that regardless of, you know, how she was formed, that this is how she was meant to be.
Sure.
So.
Sure. That was God's plan for her.
Exactly.
And for you guys.
Little did we know.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, the remainder of the pregnancy, was there any sort of update that it wasn't going to be, as severe as you were initially under the impression of, or you went through the rest of the pregnancy thinking it
yeah.
was as they had originally said?
Yeah. So we actually like hoped, kind of went into hope for the best, prepare for the worst mode. You know, the swelling continued to progress in her brain, and we were in that sort of helpless mode of like, you know, things are getting worse, but it's so severe so early that her prognosis was so poor that they said that there's no point in delivering her early, and the best chance we could give her was just to, you know, just keep her inside as long as possible. And, you know, there's some babies with that condition that actually are born early and tried to, you know, place the shunt to drain the fluid early, but they ended up, you know, saying that, no, the best thing to do is just wait and let her, you know, get as strong as she can. And it was just, you know, kind of meeting with a specialist. I ended up having a fetal MRI. So I had to, you know, as I was pregnant, go into the hospital and have an MRI done on this baby. And, I mean, it was a pretty traumatic experience.
Sure.
Just to kind of go through that. But so, yeah, we got checked every week with ultrasounds, and it was, you know, it was always kind of the same thing. Like, yeah, this is really bad. And it wasn't really until we met with a neurologist, and he was pretty much the same thing. Poor prognosis. She'll never walk or talk, you know, the very low likelihood of her having any quality of life at all. And then we ended up meeting with the neurosurgeon. And so the plan was to place a shunt to drain this excess fluid that would be permanent as soon as she was born. So we ended up meeting with her ahead of time just to kind of get acquainted and, you know, hear her plan. And she was the first person that actually offered us any kind of hope. She said, you know, oh, well, this is okay. Like, this is, you know, more common than you'd think. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've known people with hydrocephalus that go to medical school. And I remember leaving that appointment like, okay, on one hand, I have this doctor telling me that, you know, nothing is good is ever going to happen. And then this other one that's telling me that, you know, my child might be okay. So at that point, we really didn't know what to expect. So
right. So you almost like the default position is try to lay in somewhere in the middle.
Yes.
So you can kind of have your defense mechanisms to kind of prepared, prepped, ready to go either way.
Yeah, I mean, it was really hard at first. I didn't want to decorate the nursery. I didn't want to, you know, get too attached. And it took me a while to kind of just realize, like, no, this is okay. Like, she still deserves, mm-hmm. you know, no matter what, like, she still deserves me to be her mom and to be excited. And, you know, it's definitely a process to kind of get there.
Sure, and it's human nature to try and apply your own plans, your own thoughts, or your own expectations of how things will go.
Yeah.
But to always remind yourself, that's the hardest part, it seems like, is to always have to remind yourself that I don't really have a say in this. This mm-hmm. is God's plan. So
yeah.
I can either keep those defense mechanisms going, or I can just dive fully in. And that's when I hear people talk about faith,
mm-hmm.
that's exactly what I think of, is just that one step in front of the other.
Exactly.
Just going.
Yep. It's one breath, 1 minute, one, you know, hour sometimes at a time, and just kind of learning to trust. I mean,
sure. So then we get to the point of where now you're going forward with the birth.
Yeah. So it was kind of a big day. We had a planned C-section because her head was going to be too large to deliver normally. So, you know, we had the whole family down there. Everybody's excited. You know, we didn't know what to expect. We had the neurosurgeons kind of at the ready, waiting to do this surgery that she would need to have done. And she was born in the special delivery unit. And I remember the doctor held her up for the first time, and I looked at her face, and I was like, oh, my goodness. Like, I didn't know what I had expected. But
sure.
Like, you know, this is your baby, and she was just adorable. And, you know, miraculously, she was breathing on her own, and nothing had to be done urgently. They checked her out, but they said, well, we're just going to mm-hmm. kind of see how things go, and we'll have her be in the NICU and keep an eye on her. So it ended up 5 days later, they kind of waited through the weekend, and then they knew that she was going to need the shunt. So they placed the shunt. She had brain surgery, and that was another very traumatic day, you know, handing over
sure.
this small little person, you know, to go to surgery and have brain surgery when they're, you know, not even a week old.
Sure. That's probably, I would imagine that's probably an extremely helpless feeling and situation.
It is the most helpless I think I've ever felt, is there's nothing that you can do
sure.
To protect your child. And it is necessary to have her go through something painful to help her. And that, you know, I don't think there's anything harder that you can decide as a parent.
Right. And to stay in that situation, what was something that helped you? Because the mind probably started running and racing, aside from all the emotions, and you were probably mm-hmm. physically drained.
Yeah.
The mind can kind of just go sometimes, and it's hard to slow it down. What mm-hmm. was something that helped you kind of not really get to an ease, but head in that direction? Was there something, or?
Sure. I mean, I think that trauma has a way of really clarifying your faith. So for me, pretty early on, we started, you know, just claiming scriptures. And, you know, I think that it brings you to a point where it's like, well, this is something that I have said that I believed, and, you know, that I know is real, but it's becomes very black and white. Yeah. So there's not really a whole lot of gray. And I think that, you know, it just becomes very clear, like, this is either real or it's not. And if it's real, then this has everything that I need. You know, there's unlimited power in prayer. There's unlimited power in the Word of God, and you know, there's support, and you know, and if it's not real, then you know, I guess I've really messed up. But it just became very clear to me that that was what I needed to cling to. And I think that a lot of people, you know, will say, well, God will never give you anything more than you can handle. And I have found that to be incredibly untrue.
I agree.
And because I think that he gives you, he allows things into your life that are far more than we could ever handle on our own to teach us how to depend on him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the basis of faith to me is, hey, I'm gonna throw all this on you, and know that you're gonna have to come back to me and rely on me, and that, to me, that progresses somebody in their faith so much more.
Yeah,
I've heard that saying too, and I've always felt differently when I hear that.
Yeah,
because it is, and I've also heard, you know, faith is a crutch, or religion is a crutch, or spirituality is a crutch, and yeah, it's absolutely a crutch because my spiritual legs are broken and I need that crutch.
Yeah.
I can't do it by myself.
No, I totally agree.
So in those moments, you kind of find that when it's almost tested to the point of, because I've been in that situation too. I remember with my brain tumor situation where it's time for me to walk this walk that I kind of talked before, kind of believed, and it was kind of time to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it is. It's time to live it out. And, you know, I think that in that you find that there is real strength and there is real power and there is, you know, tangible evidence of the Lord's, you know, fingerprints in your life.
Sure.
And so.
Sure, absolutely. So surgery all the way to home.
Yeah, so surgery to home was actually not as bad as we thought. She did really well. But the second kind of bombshell after the surgery was, that, you know, they had noticed that her neck was kind of turned a little bit differently, and they had sort of surmised that maybe this was like a muscle thing or a neurologic thing. Maybe, you know, she was paralyzed in some way, you know, certain muscles because of the, you know, brain issue or something. But then it was after her shunt surgery that they did some x-rays to confirm the placement. And they saw that she had some pretty severe spinal and bony deformities. So so that kind of launched us into this whole other world of, okay, well, now we know there was a brain thing, and there's now a bone thing, and
sure.
Now there's probably other things. So then it sort of further evolved, and we started looking at kidneys and heart and everything else, and found out that she actually has some pretty significant abnormalities of most of her internal organs. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So kind of like a no stone left unturned thing after that, just to.
Yeah, they started looking at a lot, and you know, I went home with all this information, but none of it really meant anything yet because I still have this little girl that was mine that was still my baby, and I still had to take care of her, and I still didn't know where we were going. Like, I have no idea where things are going to end up. I used to hang my hat on these neurology appointments, like, okay, surely at this visit they're going to be able to tell me, like, what's going to be, you know, how. And I just learned after a while, it was like everybody just kind of kept saying, well, we'll just wait and see.
Yeah, and the fear of the unknown can definitely play tricks on you.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, you can't see. It's like a fog almost where you're in it. You can't really see ahead of you what's up there.
Yeah.
So you kind of just have to keep going. And it's so scary at times to trust that there's further roads ahead, you know, through that foggy. If that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can't really, you don't know where you're going, you know, and I think one of the greatest, you know, like faults of humanity is this illusion of tomorrow. Like, nothing's guaranteed, you know, not the next hour, not tomorrow, nothing. And, you know, that's where I think faith is all the more important because, you know, if you know that there is something beyond tomorrow, then no matter what, like, that's the goal. That's, you know, that's where what you're living with in mind. And so just keeping that perspective.
Right. So she, how often were you going to the doctors?
She had over 120 appointments in her first year of life.
Oh, wow.
And just in her first year of life alone. You know, she had accumulated over 10 specialists, had multiple surgeries, you know, and we really, we didn't end up getting like her full picture of diagnosis until she was about 3. And we finally got, you know, this metabolic diagnosis of glycogen storage disease, which is a condition where your body doesn't store sugars properly. So she had had some multiple hospitalizations and still had like kept having low blood sugars and things, and she wasn't growing properly. And so we found out that she has this condition and kind of got that fine-tuned with some diet things. And then once that sort of ironed itself out, she started kind of taking off a little bit developmentally. So
what was something that helped you during the time of all those doctor's visits? Because that sounds like a grind, a grueling process. I mean, was that something where you, in addition to your faith, did that help build your relationship with your husband, or was that something that really kind of tried that relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I have to say that I am so, so grateful for the person that my husband is, because he is where I can get really anxious and wrapped up in things, and I'm the planner and the details. He is the calm and the steady. And I think that, you know, we are brought together for a reason. And
sure.
I think we just work really well together, kind of like definitely balance each other out. And, you know, I motivate him sometimes and he brings me down. So
sure.
And he's was a great dad and was very involved. Or still is very involved, and just really like kind of sat in it with me. And, you know, we'd go to doctor's appointments together, and we had a lot of family help. You know, I think our relationship definitely was strengthened just because the only person on the face of the planet that loves your child like you do is, you know, your spouse.
Sure.
And so, you know, we were really in it together. So,
sure.
Yeah.
She's home. She's growing the best that she could, kind of getting adjusted. Mm-hmm. And you guys were doing that grueling process of
lots of appointments,
all the appointments and stuff. Mm-hmm. But that wasn't the only thing that was on your plate her first year of life.
Yeah. So when she was about 7 months old, I noticed, you know, I was nursing and I noticed a lump. And I'm like, well, this is a little bit strange. So I went to the doctor and ended up with an ultrasound and going to a breast surgeon, and she said, oh, it's just a cyst, you know, we'll just watch mm-hmm. it. So she said, come back when you're done nursing. So I came back in 6 months and she said, well, you know, that one's still okay, but now there's this other lump. And I'm like, what are you talking about? So she showed me and I said, okay, yeah, I never really had felt that one. So she said, well, it's probably nothing. It's really small. We'll just kind of keep an eye on it. So just come back in 3 months. So I went back in 3 months. Well, it hasn't really changed, so we'll just keep an eye on it. Come back in 6 months. So by that time, you know, that was March of 2014. Meg was had just turned 2. And, you know, we were still really kind of intensely involved in all that. And so I went back in 6 months, and at that visit, she said, well, you know, I think it's time. We need to biopsy this. So
sure.
I had the biopsy, and it was inconclusive, and so I ended up having to, like, go in the hospital and actually have it, like, surgically removed, and waited the weekend, and 5 days later, she called me at the end of the day and said, I'm really sorry, but, you know, this is invasive ductal carcinoma. It's breast cancer. And I pretty much just, like, kind of hit the ground.
Sure.
Because it was just, you know, I think initially when we had found the lump, it was like, I have somebody that's telling me that we'll just watch it. Don't worry about it. I was so busy kind of, like, dealing with Meg and stuff and just trying to, like, stay on top of, you know, all her appointments. And it's like, okay, you know, great. Somebody's telling me don't worry. I'm not worried. So I just kind of trusted her,
right.
And you know, just kind of went along. So
right.
Unfortunately, by the time we found out that it was cancer, it had spread to my lymph nodes, and so that means kind of a pretty different treatment course. So after we figured out that it was cancer, 2 weeks later, I ended up having a mastectomy. And about 4 weeks after that, I started chemo. And so that was 2014, was the year of cancer treatment. So
I've always heard there's a, for every action, there's a reaction. And I remember being in the doctor's office, and once I heard the words brain tumor, I remember seeing his mouth move and hearing, but there was like this weird numbness that came over me. And I remember like, no, check that, check the chart.
Yeah.
That's not me.
Yeah.
I'm good. Don't worry. That's not me. But then that realization that there was like this weird, it's hard to describe, but it was like a numbing feeling.
It's a very visceral numbing. Like I completely relate to that, because it's, I will never forget that moment of just like hearing the words cancer, and you're just like, this is not possible. You know, I was 32 years old. You know, I have two little kids. There is no history of, you know, young premenopausal breast cancer in the family. No other history of cancer, except my dad had a little melanoma thing. You know, I was healthy. I was working out. I was running, doing all the things that I needed to do to keep myself what I thought healthy, and here I have cancer. I also do remember a distinct sense of relief that it was happening to me and not one of my family members. So it was lots of crazy emotion and just, you know, disbelief, certainly.
Was there any second guessing, or what, when you first found the lump, which ultimately ended up kind of leading you in the direction of a different lump or a different situation. For any females that feel a lump, was there, I mean, were you overly confident? Were you just like skeptical? Like, what would you tell them if they think they feel or kind of feel or know that they feel?
If I'm talking to another woman that thinks that she feels a lump, my advice now is go to the doctor and do not quit until, if you feel like there's something wrong and you need a biopsy, be your own advocate.
Control your care.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, being in the medical field, it is unfortunate that we have to advocate for ourselves, but we do. And, you know, I would think that I have, you know, maybe above average knowledge when it comes to, you know, medical things, unfortunately, and I still didn't advocate for myself. So I think that there's something to be explored there, and, you know, why don't we feel comfortable, or, you know, is there, was it just, you know, a trust of, you know, the person that they really knew what they were doing, or was it simply that I was so, you know, traumatized at the time with dealing with everything with Megan that I couldn't kind of process through that and advocate? I'm not really sure what it was, but my advice would certainly be, please, you know, go get yourself checked, and don't stop if you feel uncomfortable, you know, to be your own advocate.
What was the time frame? What was the gap in time from diagnosis and chemo plan to driving there for the first day
of chemo? First day of chemo.
What was the time gap?
Diagnosis was April 7th, and first day of chemo, I believe, was May 21st. So, you know, I had surgery in the middle of that. So it was like 2 weeks until I had my surgery, and then, you know, another 4 weeks or so, 4 or 5 weeks until I started chemo. So
I would imagine those weeks were extremely long.
Yeah, it was a very surreal place to be in, because I didn't feel sick, you know.
Sure.
You know, you've just been diagnosed with cancer, and you know you have this terrible thing that's like living inside of you. But you're still, everything's pretty normal. And then, you know, it's kind of going through this very odd unfolding of events where, you know, there's, you know, people that come to support you, and, you know, like people want to do fundraisers and, you know, all those kind of things unfolding. And in the same time, you're still trying to like take care of your family and wondering like what's really going to happen, what's chemo going to be like. You know, I know from being in the medical field that, you know, sometimes it's not the cancer that kills people, but chemo, you know, like that was really scary to me. So there's a lot of unknowns, certainly surrounding that. So
there was something really cool that you were doing though, kind of in that time, with everything that was going on with Megan, mm-hmm. and the uncertainty of if she was going to be able to walk,
yes,
you had made it a commitment to her,
yes,
which I am completely amazed with. This is cool. Can you tell me about this thing?
Sure. So, you know, it's some kind of something to be diagnosed with cancer when you're in your early 30s and you're a young mom. You know, I had surgery, I had the mastectomy, and I chose not to have reconstruction for a lot of different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
So now I came out of this, you know, surgery and, you know, going through this whole chemo process, and now I have a port and I have, you know, scars, and I'm going to lose my hair, and all of these things are happening that were very, very physical. And I finished my first chemo, and I remember after, you know, it was about 5 or 6 days, and you kind of start to feel a little better and you start to walk. And I had been running all along, because I made a promise to Megan when she was just a few months old that I would run a half marathon every year in her honor until she could walk or I couldn't.
That's awesome.
Yeah, well, thank you. And it was just something that was kind of just something to, I don't know, it inspired me. It inspired me to watch her fight every single day, and unknowingly. She didn't know she was fighting. She was just, you know, living, but struggling to do the things that, you know, most babies just, you know, just do. And we as parents took for granted completely the first time around. So,
sure.
So I made that commitment, and after the first chemo and I started to feel better, I was like, I still want to run. So I remember well, I'm at home. I'm not going to do anything crazy. I'm just going to get on the treadmill.
Right.
But I laced up my running shoes and I got on the treadmill, and I remember I just ran, and I ran 2 miles, and I remember just like completely losing it, because I was just like, okay, you know, I might have cancer. Everything in my world right now might be different, but my promise to my daughter is not going to change. And so I just said, I'm just going to keep running. So I did. So I trained for a half marathon while I was going through chemo.
Wow. That training is a metaphor for, it seems like, how you've lived, at least from her, pregnancy with her,
sure,
up until this point, that I'm just going to keep going.
Yeah.
Just keep going.
You just lace up your shoes and you keep on running.
Keep on running.
Yep.
So you ran.
So I did. So there was a few days, you know, usually during like when I'd get chemo, like a 3 or 4 days after that, it'd be pretty low. And there were times when I would just go to the park, and I could barely even walk. I could just like maybe make it for 15 or 20 minutes, just one foot in front of the other, just trying to kind of keep moving forward. But then I'd start to feel a little better. And then, you know, after about 7 days or so, I'd walk a little faster. And then in that 2 week period between chemos, then I would run the miles that I needed to run.
Sure.
And sometimes it was a run walk. You know, I certainly wasn't going for time, but
right,
it made me feel really good to just be like still doing what I promised that I would do.
Absolutely.
So
when it would have been easier to just kind of put that on the back burner, because you had, if you had two plates, they were both full.
Yeah.
You know, you had your daughter's thing and then your thing.
Yeah.
Both full, but you kept going.
Yeah.
So I think that's really inspiring. I think that's really neat. And so how was the half marathon?
It was pretty crazy. I mean, I remember just, you know, here I am. I had just actually finished chemo in September. I had started radiation. So I was 2 weeks into radiation. And so I remember feeling like, this is really weird, because I have these, like, I'm starting to get burns on my chest and I'm pretty much completely bald. And, you know, I probably look like a total hot mess, because I've got a, you know, port sticking out of my neck, and I just look like a person that should not be running a marathon. But, you know, I showed up, and, you know, this was it's the Nationwide Children's half marathon. So it's actually when I first started running the half marathons, that was the one that I had picked to run for Megan, because every mile they have a patient champion. So they have these kids that are out there that are cheering you on, that are living with chronic illnesses and things. And so it's just, it's really inspiring to watch them, you know, cheering for you doing something. So it was great to kind of be a part of that. And so I got to be out there and, you know, just run for my daughter. Even though, you know, here's where we are, but, you know, right. I've kind of trained for this and went through the whole chemo running for this day, and this is what I'm going to do. So, you know.
And you.
And I completed it.
There finished. You go.
Yep.
There you go.
Yep. Wasn't my best time, but that is okay.
Well, that's probably to be expected.
Yes.
But you made it through.
I did.
That's exciting. So then after that, you got into radiation. And
yeah. Finished up radiation. That was another, you know, few weeks after that, and kind of went through that process. And, you know, since then I've had, you know, another surgery. I had the prophylactic removal of my other breast. I had my ovaries removed to kind of take the estrogen, the rest of the estrogen out of my body. I've been on some medication. So, you know, certainly, even though cancer, like active treatment, is over, you know, it's never really over.
Right. It's a life change.
It's a significant life change. And I think that that's one of, has been probably the most challenging part about cancer for me, is that it wasn't really given the active treatment. It wasn't the running. It wasn't any of that that was, you know, that is something that I can do. That is some putting one foot in front of the other.
Mm-hmm. You know, mind over matter.
Mind over matter. I know that I can survive through that. The most difficult part, I think, for me has been learning how to thrive after cancer, because now, you know, when you're in treatment, it's like, okay, I have this finish line over here. Mm-hmm. And I know that if I just get there, that I'm going to be okay. But then after cancer, everything is very different. And, you know, now you're like, well, now there's no finish line. Now it's just, this is where I am, and I have to learn.
It's the long game.
Exactly. Now I have to completely change how I think about life and how I think about my body and how I think about my relationships and how I, you know, all of that. And then you have to learn how to live in that. And that, I think, has been really hard.
Because even though all that's gone on, all that's still going on, mm-hmm. There's ups and downs. There's good days. There's bad days. There's days where, just like anybody else, and I'm sure, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there's probably been a situation where you've had, where you just weren't feeling right, mm-hmm. or something just felt off, mm-hmm. and then your mind maybe wanders to, uh-oh, is it, here we go again type of thing?
Yeah, sure.
Because, like, for me, I know that any time that I have
a headache,
a hard headache, or, you know, something, like, just anything head-related, my mind starts to wander.
Yeah.
And it goes right back to, oh, no, here we go again. What's going on? Have you experienced that?
I've experienced that a little bit. I'd say that, you know, I think that I've been through enough now that I feel like I'm sort of surrendered to the plan. Like, whatever happens from this point on is really not up to me. So I feel like it's, you know, whatever the Lord's plan is for my life, like, that's what it's going to be. And I'm okay with that. Like, I remember distinctly praying before I went in for the surgery for the biopsy. Like, my mother-in-law asked me, she's like, how do you want me to pray? And I'm like, just whatever his will is, whether this is cancer or not, that's what it would be. So there was a certain piece, like, when it was cancer, I was like, okay, like, I know that this was his will in my life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that he's going to use it somehow. I watched how he used Megan in multiple situations. And so it was like, okay, we know how to do hard, and I know how to do difficult things now.
Right.
So I'm okay with whatever happens, I think, from here on out. I think the harder part was, it's not really the fear. It's more just like living in like the changed reality and grieving, continuing to grieve over the things that have been lost. Like, mm-hmm. that's still, I think, a little bit of a struggle.
There's this really cool thing, though, that happens too when you mm-hmm. make it through a situation where you're able to stop as you're looking forward, but you're able to kind of look back and realize, like, there's more victories back there mm-hmm. than there's going to be battles up there.
Yeah.
It seems like people are able to find peace in that, or at least some excitement in that, to know that I can do anything now mm-hmm. Because I've made it through this, yeah. or I'm making it through this. Have you felt that?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of things that I'm no longer afraid of because of all of this, things like being on a podcast or
right.
standing up in front of, almost 3,000 people and talking about, my experience as a patient. You know, there's some really cool things that have come out of it, and it has given me a boldness, I think, in life, and also in just like discussing my faith and talking about those things, because I think sometimes people are really like, oh, I don't want to offend anybody,
sure. and,
but those things are very real to me. So I think that it's sort of just given me this, like, this platform and come to this place where it's like, this is what I believe. And then also in the looking back, being able to see like just how incredibly amazing, just how we were carried through these experiences, and how, there were people that walked beside us, there were just incredible blessings that came out of it. I had a friend of mine who kind of showed up when I got diagnosed. She was a friend, but she ended up just not leaving my side.
Right.
And she was there for every single chemo except one. She, to this day, takes me to all of my oncology appointments.
Wow.
And goes with me. And so, like, and that was something I didn't even know that I would need, and didn't know that I would still need that today. And so I get to like look back and say, oh my goodness, I had this amazing gift of this friendship that I would have probably not gotten to experience in that way if it weren't for this situation.
Right.
So there's definitely lots of amazing things about looking back and saying, like, goodness, like, I've gotten to do so much, and
right.
so many positives have come out of the situation.
Right. And even in, like, for me in my own life, even small situations, or in the big scheme of life, they're kind of small.
Mm-hmm.
And this will kind of relate to like a CrossFit workout for you, where in the past, or maybe other people, or in the past, even for yourself, you would question whether you could complete that task, complete that workout or something. And you're kind of, it seems like for me, when I'm faced with something, a workout isn't the biggest deal in the world,
mm-hmm.
but it's still something that you go through and you have to push. There's like a progress with the pain type mm-hmm. of thing,
Yeah, sure.
So I would imagine that you've been able to kind of, even with your CrossFit workouts, push through based on an experience that's not even related to CrossFit.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I actually tried CrossFit before I got diagnosed, and I was like, I just can't do this. This is way too hard. Like, my body is not cut out for this. But after going through treatment, I realized that, well, now I'm in menopause, and the only way that you can build bone density, is to, besides medication, is to, like, increase your resistance training.
Mm-hmm.
So get stronger. So I had a couple of really good friends that encouraged me to try it again, and went back in. And so, yeah, I've been able to kind of, I'm definitely stronger now than I was before I went through treatment. So
is there, and maybe CrossFit workout is the answer to this question, but is there, what's one resource that you relied on, a book, some sort of music, Bible verse, something that, if you could say the one thing that you've relied on the most, that resource, what would that be?
I think it definitely is just like is scripture. I mean, there's several verses that I can think about that really, it says in the Bible that the word of God is living and active, and it does have power. And, there's just several things, everything from Megan's verse that we claimed to, for I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord, plans to prosper you and not to harm you, plans to give you a hope in a future. And that's Jeremiah 29:11. And that, just realizing that even through the stuff that, this world has to throw at you, like cancer and disability and, all of these things, that are struggles and trials and death and everything, the Lord intends it to be used for good. And so, that's just kind of something that carries me.
Sure. What was And I'll give you an example of this for my own life, just to put it in kind of context.
Sure.
What is your favorite failure throughout your process? For me, it was, especially that summer in 2005, it was May when I was diagnosed with the brain tumor.
Okay.
Surgery in July.
Yeah.
Especially from May and June and part of July, and then that kind of recovery, when they told me there was residual tumor, pretending that I was fine at all times and never showing any emotion, even to my family, even to my parents or siblings, that was a failure on my part. I wasn't, it was like I tried to be so even keel about the situation to where I ended up just kind of harboring and holding it all in. And I look back as I've opened up over the years, especially with those close to me, and there's times where I, you know, in those coming years where I'd sit down and cry or something. But that first, when I was going through the kind of the heart of it, I was holding it all in. And I view that as almost like a failure that I've learned from. That's like my favorite failure almost. If that, I know that sounds weird.
It doesn't though. I mean, it's really, it's interesting because I feel like that's kind of where I am right now, is that I've just kind of come through this, like, we've just been in this survival mode for so long. And now we're in a place where, like, you know, all those repeated traumas, those things that you don't have to deal with, are kind of like dying down. And now this is like, okay, we're in like sort of regular life. And now I'm like starting to kind of deal with some of those things and realizing all of the stuff that I have held on to and haven't really like allowed myself to kind of process through. And yeah, that's definitely, definitely a failure on my part to like deal with that. But I don't know if it's like, if it's a failure that is, could have been different, or if that's just kind of like, you know, that's just the process that you go through, you know,
and it might be,
maybe it is. I mean, I think that as I look back, my favorite failure, that I can think of, is, this is going to sound really strange, but, is probably Megan, because at first I viewed that as like, you know, you, when I think my, one of my faults is being a perfectionist. And, so you have this plan for your life and everything is going to go according to plan. And here's, you know, get married and have kids, and here's one kid, and now we're going to wait 2 years, and like, here's the next one. And, you know, special needs was not in my plan, and, you know, disability was not in my plan. Cancer certainly wasn't either, but I think like, my growth really started when I saw how Megan and her life just completely changed ours for the better. And so what I initially thought of was like, I failed my husband, you know, I failed my family, because now we have to live in this world, and I could not have been more wrong. Because this tiny little, you know, human that is now a complete force to be reckoned with, just completely changed our perspective, opened our eyes to an entirely different community, really kind of opened my eyes to my own perceptions about disability, and realizing, you know, I had to work through some of that stuff, and realizing that it does not matter what your abilities or disabilities are, that your life has purpose and meaning and value, like, completely separately apart from all of that. And, you know, I know some friends whose kids cannot even blink on their own, and watching the way that they shine their light, just of joy and of love and really of Jesus, like, through their, the way that they live their lives, has been like the greatest blessing. So yeah,
it's hard. It's definitely difficult in life to fix a focus, you know, like you're focused on, like you had mentioned, you were kind of focused on in your mind what you had laid out for your life, the plan. And when you have to fix that, alter that focus to something else.
Yeah.
It's difficult.
It is.
It's difficult for sure. What is some advice, if you could give a piece of advice to, whether it's a similar situation or completely different, but somebody in a difficult time, that difficult season that we talk about, what's a piece of advice that you would give somebody?
I'd say, you know, first of all, just keep going. Even if it's you take one more breath, you know, you live one more minute, you get through one more hour, because there are those moments where you just feel like everything's falling apart. How am I ever going to get through this? And you do. You have to just keep persevering. But there is, strength and comfort and peace available in that perseverance through a relationship with the Lord. That's definitely, I'd say my biggest piece of advice is just that, your strength has to come from somewhere. I think a lot of people want to say, like, you're so strong, or like, or your strength comes from within, and, you have to like find it inside of yourself. And there are times when I'm like, I do not feel strong. I do not have strength on my own. I need to get that from somewhere else. And, the real strength, definitely comes from the Lord. So.
Sure. All right. Give me an update on Megan.
So Megan is now 5 years old, and she is this incredible little person. Both of my kids are incredible. My daughter, Addison, she always kind of gets left out of the conversation. So she's great. She is the best big sister to this little girl. She is the very patient and just wonderful. And Meg, actually, 6 months after I ran that half marathon for her, took her first steps.
Wow.
So that was a really amazing season to kind of watch her start to grow and take off. And, we just kind of kept from day one, somebody was always in her face, like just talking to her and teaching her stuff and just kind of treating her like any other child. And I, remember, the first time that she started kind of babbling, I was like, oh my goodness, like, okay, like we can do this. And so we just, kept pouring into her. And so, so now she's 5, she's going to school. She's doing almost everything that they said that she would never do.
Sure.
She certainly has her share of health challenges, and our daily life is, quite different than, other people's based around her medical needs. But, we had the amazing opportunity to get a service dog for her. So he helps her with balance and mobility and some behavior disruptions and things like that. And, it's definitely not the life I would have pictured, but I have this entirely beautiful life that I, have been blessed to live and have had these opportunities that, have just changed me in such a way that I'm so grateful for all of that we went through, because, I am so much better for it than I was.
Sure. I think after sitting down with you today and hearing everything that you've said, I think I get the vibe that I would summarize your entire situation, that you've gone from like surviving to thriving now. And I think it's just really inspiring, and there's a lot of courage that just pours out of you.
Thank you.
I think it's just really neat to be around.
I appreciate that. I think that, when you've gone through something as significant as you have, having a brain tumor, it changes your focus. It changes your perspective. Mm-hmm. And
and there's power in perspective.
Definitely power in perspective. I wish that I could go back and give myself some of the perspective I have now. If I could just, like, in that moment when we were getting diagnosed with Meg's, issues in that room, if I could have just, like, gone back and shown myself a picture of, like, okay, here's where you're going to be, and not only is she going to be here, you're going to be this entirely different person.
Right.
That is so much better than you are right now. That perspective, but you got to walk through that stuff to get there. So
sure. Well, thank you so much for sitting down and joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Like I said in the intro, if you want to know more about Sarah's story, first you can go to jascawleyfamily.blogspot.com. jascawleyfamily.blogspot.com. This is also going to be part one. Sarah and I have already talked about doing a part two, so that'll be coming at you in the near future. Thanks for listening. If you have any questions, likes, dislikes, want to be on a future episode of the podcast, you can go to www.brandongrim.org/podcast. You can also find all of the episodes on anchor.fm/Brandon Grimm. You can find me on all social media at Brandon Graham 247. Talk to you soon. Thanks.